Thanks, guys, for having me and giving me a chance to talk. So I want to talk about some work that I've done jointly with, well, various combinations of these people, Simon Burton and Steve Flamir at the University of Sydney, and then Guillaume Depenay and David Poulin at Sherbrooke. And there's a couple of papers and some other ongoing work that I'm going to talk about. So, as in so many cases, you could trace back the motivation to what I want to talk about to a Kataev paper, and in particular, it's going to be this one, fault-tolerant quantum computation by anions. And this really, the idea behind this paper is that we want to use somehow topological features, which is where the anions come in. I'm going to talk about this a little bit more, to give us some natural way to do computation that's robust from certain sources of noise. So doing fault-tolerant quantum computation is extremely difficult thing to do. I mean, typically it would require a lot of overhead and a lot of resources to try and get some fault tolerance in your quantum computer. And if you use some anionic system, then some of this comes for free. And the basic idea is that you expect sources of noise to act locally. So I mean, you have some system in the lab and you expect thermal noise to act independently at each site. So you don't expect it to act in a correlated way over the entire system or over long distances. So if your noise acts locally, then you should encode information in global degrees of freedom. And this is basically exactly what John Wan's talk was just about, right? It's exactly the same ideas. And in fact, I mean, this paper is where the Tor code that John Wan talked about was introduced. So we can use these ideas to define a scheme of topological quantum computation. And this is some picture, which is supposed to represent doing computation by doing braiding of anions. So I'm going to describe this in a little bit more detail. But we're going to encode information in global degrees of freedom in order to kind of take advantage of this protection against local sources of noise. And in particular, the global degrees of freedom that we're going to encode information in is fusion spaces of anions. So all of this will become more concrete when I go on in a second. And then gates are going to somehow correspond to topological invariants. So in this case, it's going to be about braiding of anions. And we only care about the knots that the world lines of these anions form. And that's really what gives us some notion of topological robustness. It's in gate errors. So as we're trying to perform a gate, it doesn't really matter if we screw up how we're moving this thing around. These gates correspond to topological invariants, and by construction, they're stable to deformation. So that's the sense in which Kataev meant fault tolerance. But I mean, typically when you talk about fault tolerance in a quantum computer, you would talk about fault tolerance with respect to like errors and error correction and so on. Some external sources of errors instead of just gate errors. So this has some robustness to gate errors, but you still require some active error correction on top to deal with external sources of error. Okay. So I guess the summary of what this talk is about is how can we design and benchmark error correction protocols for these topological quantum computers? That's the goal of this work. So we want to build a topological quantum computer because it gives you something for free, but you still need to do some error correction, and how can we simulate that, basically, is what we want to talk about. So here's an overview of the talk. I'm going to first give some introduction to anion theories and a simple topological quantum computer based on Ising anions. And then we're going to look at how we would model noise and error correction protocols in this kind of computer and show what happens when we are able to simulate these. But the Ising anions are actually an extremely simple class of anions, and you can't build a universal quantum computer with them. And in the most naive studies of simulating this kind of error correction, you take advantage of this fact. And it might seem at face value that if you are trying to simulate the dynamics of anions, which you can use for doing universal quantum computation, that you're not going to have very much fun. But that's what we're going to look at in the last part of the talk, which is about simulating the same kinds of noise and error correction protocols for universal anion computers. And we're going to exploit some structure of noise and error correction processes to do this, and we'll show how this works out. So let's proceed. So in 2D, these topologically ordered systems have localized quasiparticles that are called anions. In contrast to bosons or fermions, they can have some interesting fractional braid statistics. They're very cool. So let's talk about what they are. Well, we have some definition of what kind of anions we have. And
you should basically think about these as conserved charges. And I'm going to use the example of the Ising anions. There's always, in every anion theory, a preferred charge that's vacuum. I mean, nothing, zero charge. And in the Ising anions, there's two other ones, which are typically called psi and sigma. So we have some manifold with some particles in it. And some of these particles have label sigma associated with them. There's some notion of a conserved charge at that point of sigma. And some other excitations have the label psi. And the background is just vacuum. But it has a label in the anion theory. And as well as associating these conserved charges to a point, you can also ask, well, what's the charge within a region? And so if I ask what's the charge within this region, I should get back sigma. Right? So these conserved charges can be associated with regions of the lattice, not just with specific particles themselves. And that's important when we talk about fusion of anions. So we might ask, what happens if two particles combine? What's the total charge? So if I have a particle of type A and a particle of type B, this equation is how we write the fact that they can combine to make a total charge C or D or some other things, I mean, depending on how this expands. So you should think of this like addition of angular momentum. So if I have a spin half and another spin half, then they can combine to make total spin zero or total spin one. I mean, and in general, you can have this same kind of expansion structure. This is the best analogy if you're not familiar with anion theories. And there's some, well, okay, so we can give some diagrammatic calculus to describe this. And this is a diagram that's saying that if I have, well, I can read it as a space-time diagram. Space runs horizontally and time runs vertically. I can either read it forwards in time or backwards in time. If I read it down the page, I have a particle A and B, and they're going to fuse to some specific charge C. If I read it up the page, I have a particle C, and it splits into A and B. So this could be like a pair creation process. There's also some sensible rules that all of these things should obey. So there's the vacuum shouldn't do anything. If I combine something with vacuum, it should be the same. Otherwise, why did I call it vacuum? And there's also a notion of an antiparticle. So that's denoted here a bar. So there's some particle for an A such that I can combine it, and the total charge can possibly be vacuum. So in reverse, this gives me some way of pair creating a particle and an antiparticle from nothing. So the Ising anions have this particular set of fusion rules. So two psi particles are their own antiparticles. So if I bring them together, I just get vacuum back. This rule is kind of a bit counterintuitive. If I bring a psi particle and fuse it with a sigma particle, I just get back a sigma particle. So it seems like the psi is acting like vacuum, but it's important. I mean, it turns out that this isn't the case. But all of the interesting behavior up here comes from really this rule. So if I have two sigma particles and I bring them together, there's two different total charges that they could have. They could have vacuum total charge, or they could have psi total charge. And they could also have some superposition of this total charge in general. So this gives me a space, a fusion space. This is a two-dimensional Hilbert space of possible fusion outcomes. And this is really what we're going to store our information in when we work with an anionic quantum computer. We're going to store information in this fusion space for the reason that imagine we're looking at the total charge of these two sigma particles. If they're far separated, then we can't manipulate or measure these different states in the fusion space by local operations. So we can make this fusion space, if we send the particles far away, this is really a global degree of freedom. It's robust to local noise in the way that we would like. Right? That's the whole idea of the game. So that's fusion. That gives us a space in which to encode information. Now we want to be able to manipulate it. And one way of manipulating that is braiding. And this answers the question, what happens if we perform an exchange of these two particles? And in 2D, you should note that a clockwise exchange and a counterclockwise exchange are distinct. So this is why we can have anions in 2D. In higher dimensions in 3D, a clockwise exchange and a counterclockwise exchange are the same because we can deform them. I mean, over the top of each other. But in 2D, when you're restricted to the plane, these things are different. So we might like to write some kind of world line diagrams for this process. So I have particle A and B and exchange them. And there's some rule. So this R matrix, This is part of the definition of the anion theory, and that tells me how I should relate a process where these things have exchanged to a process where they haven't. And a better way of describing it actually is like this. So this says, if I have two particles, A and B, that have total charge C, so they came from some original C total charge, and then I created A and B, and then I exchanged them, I can relate that to the case where they had never, where they didn't exchange, just by some phase factor, RABC. So this RABC is some phase. And so you can see that this gives you some action on the fusion space, because depending on what C is, RABC is some different number. So this gives you some gate on the fusion space. For the Ising anions, these are the numbers. But the interesting thing is that if we have two sigma particles that have total charge vacuum, we get this phase. Whereas if we have two sigma particles that have total charge psi, we get this phase. So because they're different, we have some non-trivial gate on the fusion space. This is how we manipulate information. Well, one way to manipulate information in the fusion space. So that's all that I really need to discuss things for this talk. But I mean, behind the scenes, there's a whole complicated machinery. So anion models are described by what's called modular tensor categories. This gives us all of this data about the particle types and the fusion rules, how they braid, some thing called an F-move, which is like an associator, tells you how to relate different processes where you fuse things in different orders. There's an S-matrix, which tells you something about what happens on non-trivial topologies. And all of these things satisfy some consistency conditions, the pentagon and hexagon identity, that make sure that all of these things play nicely together. And if you want to learn more about this, there's Appendix E of this paper is a pretty nice discussion of the abstract theory of anions. But we don't really need too much of this. All we need is some notion of fusion and braiding, and that'll be sufficient for my discussion today. So I've told you what an anion model is abstractly. I mean, I've given you some math that defines some anions, I claim. But how do we know that this has anything to do with physics? How do we know that I can actually build this thing in the lab, or that this is something that is reasonable to talk about? So we can realize these anionic systems in several ways. And one of the most common and most natural ones is as the low energy description of a fractional quantum Hall liquid. So these Ising anions that I've been talking about, if you're sitting at Feeling fraction 5/2, then this abstract anion theory of the Ising anions describes how quasi Halls behave in this Feeling fraction. So there's a real model in which this is actually a thing that you can point at and manipulate. I'm going to talk later about the Fibonacci anions, and they're also realizable from fractional quantum Hall at 12/5 Feeling fraction. But as well as fractional quantum Hall liquids, there's a bunch of other ways that you could imagine realizing anion theories. And I mean, there's lots of classes of spin models, like local Hamiltonians on spin models that have excitations that behave like anions. So this is a string net model. The string nets are a broad class that allow you to realize some large set of anion theories. There's a bunch of other spin models of varying generality and simplicity. And you could imagine that these are some kind of effective description for a condensed matter system, maybe. Or another thing that you could do is imagine that they're an experimental proposal for an engineered quantum system. And one place in which you might imagine building such a thing that people are pushing towards is in optical lattices. So you have some optical lattice with some neutral atoms sitting at sites, and then there's some tunneling between sites. And you can set up this tunneling so it basically realizes some spin model which has the excitations of the anion model that you're trying to consider. That's just a long way of saying that this is physics, not math. So this is actually a plausible candidate for building something in the lab where we could do quantum computation. Okay, how does the Ising anion computer work? Well, the basic idea is that we want to encode a qubit into four anions. Why four? So I told you before that if I have two anions, their possible fusion outcomes give me, their fusion outcomes are either vacuum or psi. That gives me a two-dimensional Hilbert space. Why do I want four particles to define a single qubit? Well, quite often there's a global charge constraint, so that the total charge of all the particles in your system has to be vacuum or something. So that's what we've got here. We've got four particles, and we've enforced that they have total charge vacuum. That's what this says. And if we take just the left two particles, whether or not they fuse to vacuum or psi, these are the two basis states for our qubit. So we can draw some cats around these things. Maybe this is a little intuitive. So we have some diagram of this form. This is a state such that we have two sigma particles with total charge vacuum. This is a state, two sigma particles with total charge psi. Both of them have all four particles fused to vacuum. We can have a superposition of these things if we like. And if all of these particles are well separated, then we can't distinguish these states with local operations. This is a locally indistinguishable space. So we can just like write zeros and ones for these. We can regard them as our computational basis states. How do we manipulate this information? Well, an extremely simple gate is we can draw it like this. So this is a braiding operation. So what this is supposed to denote is I take these two sigma particles, and then I exchange them clockwise once, and then clockwise again. So this is a monodromy. We take them all the way around each other. And so if this acts on some qubit state with these coefficients, we can use all of this, these R moves and so on that define the anion model to figure out how to rewrite that in terms of the original basis states. And up to a global phase, the only difference is that we pick up a minus sign here. So this is really acting like a sigma z gate on this qubit. And that's a consequence of the fact that, well, this is describing the square is because I'm doing braiding twice. This is describing how a braid acts on this space, and it turns out to equal this thing. So a sigma z gate is not particularly interesting, but it gives you a flavor for the kinds of things, how you manipulate information in a topological quantum computer. Right. So that's all I wanted to say in terms of introductory material and defining anion theories and how an Ising anion computer works. Now I want to talk about, the core of my talk, which is about error correction in these systems. How should we model it, and how should we simulate it? So a general modeling framework is, I have a lattice. It's a good place to start. At each point on my lattice, I can have an anion. So I could have a vacuum or no anion, or I could have a psi anion, or I could have a sigma anion at each point on my lattice. Or in general, I could have some superposition of these things. That's also allowed. So I have a three-dimensional Hilbert space at each point on this lattice. And that defines some configuration space for charges on the lattice. But that's not the entire Hilbert space for the system. Because imagine that I have these three particles. So this is some basis state, and this basis tensored across the lattice. But this isn't a complete description of the system for the reason that I also need to know how this sigma and that sigma fuse together. So they could fuse in principle to vacuum or to psi. So this is an extra degree of freedom that I haven't accounted for in this description. And so in order to completely specify the state of the system, you need to talk about the configuration space plus the fusion space. So the fusion space depends on the configuration. So you don't have a nice tensor product description of your system in this abstract way. You really have a direct sum structure where you take the sum over all configurations, and then for a given configuration, you have a fusion space. And then you have some nice direct sum structure. So that's a Hilbert space associated with our model. What are the kinds of natural topological operations that we should consider on this model? So I'm interested in noise, but you could think about this more generally as just what are topological operations in the system. And so pair creation is a natural thing to consider, and this should act on an edge. So if I consider this edge, I can have a pair creation of a psi and a psi here. So two antiparticles can be created at opposite ends of an edge. If I have a particle at one end of an edge, then I can have a hopping term. So this should be able to hop over here. That's a perfectly natural thing to consider. There should also be an exchange. If I have two particles next to each other, they should be able to exchange clockwise or anticlockwise. These are distinct things. And then the last kind of operation that it's natural to consider is decoherence. And what I mean by this is that I said you're allowed to have a superposition of different charges on some site. But these are things that are, like, the charge at a single site is something that's locally observable. So if you're coupled to some environment, you might expect these things to decohere with respect to one another. So basically, what I mean by decoherence is you measure the charge at some site or at all sites, say. And this is some phenomenological model of all of the topologically relevant operations that we expect on the lattice. A simple way of modeling, I mean, a particular noise model would be to set some rates for each of these processes at each time step and then run a Monte Carlo simulation, which is what we do in part. I want to note that even though I've set this up in on a lattice from the start, so it looks very discrete, you can either model a discrete space or a continuous space. It's appropriate for either situation. So a discrete space is the most appropriate thing if you're worried, if you're interested in trying to model, say, a spin system where you have actual discrete places where your particles can live. But if you're trying to model something that's more like a fractional quantum Hall liquid where it's continuum-y, then in order to do error correction, you can't look at every point in space and ask, is there an anion there? What you can actually do is divide your space into regions, into tiles, and then ask, what's the charge on this tile? And we're basically modeling a tile as a point here. So this is still all appropriate for if you're trying to do error correction in a fractional quantum Hall system, something like this. Okay, so we've got a model. How do we simulate anion dynamics within this model? And for this first part of the talk, we're going to take advantage of the fact that Ising anions are classically simulatable. So Bravi showed this in 2006. I mean, obvious consequence of this is that we don't expect to be able to build a universal quantum computer from Ising anions. Well, from topological operations on Ising anions. You can use Ising anions plus some extra tools like magic state distillation to build a universal quantum computer. So this is actually a plausible framework for a universal quantum computer. But purely topologically, these are not universal. But what we mean by they're classically simulable is that we can efficiently simulate braids on a line. So I have a line of particles, and then I do exchanges along this line of particles, and I can efficiently simulate the fusion, the evolution of the fusion space. In fact, every braid can be mapped to a Clifford operation. So the only detail to take care of, we already know how to simulate Ising anion dynamics. The only detail to take care of is, well, we know how to simulate them on a line, but we just need to map the lattice that we have to a line. So we have some, say, square lattice with spherical boundary conditions. So we allow, say, operations on this edge. All right, so let me back up a second. We need to somehow map each side of this to a line. So we could choose, say, this black line as a linear ordering of all of these sites. And then we want to know, on this linear ordering, how does an operation that interacts these two particles look? And basically, we can stretch out this line and see what happens to the edge. And so if I was just trying to hop a particle from this site to this site, then on the line, I would need to exchange it under these two particles, over this one, and then hop it to here. So a local operation on the lattice maps to a non-local operation on the line. But apart from this, everything's completely straightforward. Yes, this gives... Precisely, yeah. So that's exactly right. You can just think of this, the choice of linear ordering as a basis for the fusion space. So if I'd chosen a different line here, this would just be a different basis for the fusion space. Right. So everything's looking nice so far. We want to benchmark error correction protocols. Given this model and given this method of simulation, we want to benchmark how well error correction protocols work. That's the goal of the work. And what does an error correction protocol consist of? Three parts. We want to initialize our memory in some state. We want to apply a noise channel. And then we have some recovery map, a decoding algorithm in mind, that will return us to a code state. Error correction in a nutshell. So there's two interesting things to consider here that are a little bit different from, say, more standard error correction. One is, how do we quantify noise? So you know, if you're considering, say, a Torah code, you have some IID noise strength would typically be your noise strength parameter. But notice that the operations, that these noise operations that we defined, they don't commute with one another. So noise operations on different edges don't commute with one another. So we think it's more natural to use a noise strength given by basically the average number of errors per edge in contrast to, say, an IID noise strength. In the limit of low noise rates, these things converge anyway, so it doesn't really matter. And the other interesting question is...
Sorry, what do you mean they converge? I mean, average errors per egg could have very correlated noise, where, you know...
Oh, yeah, so this is in the situation where we're basically going to choose edges randomly. I mean, we have some rates for processes, and they act on edges independently. So I'm going to look at two situations, one which we're calling white noise-ish, where... Yeah, you just choose an edge randomly, and then you choose a process based on the allowed processes at this edge. And in that case, you have some, I mean, this is a well-defined measure. The other kind of model is that we're looking at is something more thermal. So we have like a Metropolis update rule, and then you have a temperature and so on. And we don't really need to use this to, yeah.
Okay, but the sensing with these are not IID is because the errors associated with the edges, not with the sites.
Well, I mean, in the Torah code, the errors are associated with... with the edges anyway. I mean, if you phrase the Torah code in this same framework. So it's not so much that they're associated with edges, not sites, it's that they don't commute on edges. That we think that we it seems more comfortable to use an average number of errors per edge rather than an IID noise strength. I guess it's largely a choice.
Okay,
but. Yeah, so I mean, you shouldn't, the point is that you shouldn't really think about a channel acting just on one edge by itself, because, so I mean, we have peck creation and like hopping, and you can consider decoherence to act on the end of an edge or something like this. So on one edge, we have all of these processes that act, that's fine. But if I have two edges next to each other, you shouldn't really interpret that as being independent channels acting on each edge, because these processes don't commute. That's all that I'm saying. Like a hopping term or a decoherence term doesn't commute on this edge with this edge. That's all. Right, and the other very interesting thing that happens in this framework is that, well, away from, say, linear codes, stabilizer codes, how do you quantify the success of your error correction algorithm? So, you might, so we want to say that our error correction protocol can preserve an arbitrary input state. But it turns out that we can't actually simulate arbitrary input states efficiently for the Ising anions. The structure of the simulation requires that they are basically Pauli eigenstates. So you can't really do some kind of randomized procedure and pick random code states and see how well they're preserved. But we can derive some corollaries to some nice theorems from Blum-Kahoot and some other people. And the result is that a channel preserves a space if it preserves a non-orthogonal spanning set of states of the space. So in practical terms, I have a qubit. If I can show that the zero state and the plus state, for example, are both preserved perfectly by my noise plus recovery channel, then I have a guarantee that this noise plus recovery channel acts as identity. So this is basically going to be our motivation to look at some small number of states and determine whether or not they each have some kind of threshold associated with them. And below the lowest threshold, we expect preservation of the entire space. So that's actually a very pretty little tool that we use. OK, so that's the general setup. What do we need to specify a specific implementation? Well, we need to pick a code, we need to pick a noise model, and then we need to pick a decoding algorithm. Then we've got all of the tools we need to do a simulation and see what happens. So we want to compare a couple of different codes, which we're calling fusion codes and topology codes. And fusion codes are basically exactly the thing that I was talking about before. You have, you're going to encode your information in the fusion space of some set of anions. So I pick my lattice with periodic with spherical boundary conditions, and then the code space is defined by vacuum at every site except for four preferred sites, at which there's sigma particles, and then the code space is this qubit that we use for the Ising anion computer. So it's in the fusion space of these four sigma particles. Logical operators on this code could correspond to, say, the braid that we did before would correspond to, say, swapping these two particles twice. So this is an operation that has to act along a long distance, or as the lattice becomes large. Tunneling process between these two particles would also be an example. But all of the logical operators have to act globally if these particles are well separated, macroscopically separated. The other kind of code that you could consider is more analogous to, say, the toric code, where I have non-trivial boundary conditions, periodic boundary conditions, and then, well, I didn't talk about this at all, but it turns out that even if I require vacuum at everywhere on the surface of my torus, this gives me some degenerate ground space that I can work with. So you can think about a flux running through the tube. But I mean, it's not really important for what I want to talk about. There's some cool subtleties to deal with on the torus, that the braid group is no longer, say, the braid group on the plane when you're trying to simulate all of these things. It's something called a Fox braid group. And you can end up in situations after you decode where you have a single single charge on the surface. But I'm going to gloss over all of these. If you have any interest in that, you can ask me at some other point. But these are the two kinds of codes that we're going to consider. Noise models. I said before that we're going to consider two kinds of noise models. The first is white noise. So we just pick some rates for each of these noise processes, and then we apply them randomly across the lattice some Poisson number of times. So the two examples that I'm going to show you is we have pair creation and hopping at so a strong hopping and, say, a weak pair creation, or pair creation only. But you can do whatever choice of rates that you like. And in the paper, we have a bunch. The other source of noise that we're going to consider is something more analogous to thermal noise. So we imagine that we have a Hamiltonian. And the Hamiltonian is, say, the ground space of this Hamiltonian is the code space. And it costs energy psi to create some particles. It costs energy m psi to create a psi particle. And it costs energy m sigma to create a sigma particle. And then you can have some error rates from some metropolis probabilities. The subtlety is that, well, if you have a superposition of different charges at a site in your lattice, you don't know what the energy is. So it makes most sense to consider this kind of model in the strong decoherence limit. Basically, what I mean by that is after every time step, you project into some charge eigenstate, some configuration eigenstate on the lattice. And then you know how to do these probabilities. It's basically a classical problem. That's noise models. And the last thing that we have to consider is decoders. So there's two kinds of decoders that we consider. I'm going to blur through these because I am running a bit slow. So there's matching decoders like PMA decoders that basically try and come up with some way of joining particles together with the lowest weight operator. And then there's RG decoders, which try and cluster particles on some length scale, fuse them all together, and then cluster on increasing length scales until you've finished. The idea of both of these kinds of decoders is to basically annihilate all of the particles in the lattice, obviously except the ones that some small number of preferred ones. If you have a fusion code, you need to return to a space with four particles. Cool. So I have some results. So if we want to compare the performance of these two codes, for example, we want to compare the Ising fusion code to Ising topology code on a torus. So we have some pair creation only white noise and some matching decoder to do some benchmarking. And OK, so we have the Ising fusion code. How should I read this diagram? Well, all of these lines are for different lattice sizes. And it seems that below a point around here, 0.26, that as you increase the lattice size, the error rate drops. So we infer that if you make the lattice size arbitrarily large, that the error rate should go to zero. And we would have some kind of threshold behavior here. Now, this particular plot is actually for preservation of the zero state. So just because I have an error correction protocol that preserves the zero state, that doesn't guarantee that it preserves my entire qubit. But the plot for the plus state looks basically identical. I mean, there's not much point in me putting it up because it looks the same. So below this threshold, you have the idea that in the thermodynamic limit, as L diverges, both the zero state and the plus state are perfectly preserved. And then we have we use this theorem that tells us that the entire qubit space has to be preserved. Yeah.
Is the threshold?
No. I mean, it's not resolvable up to numerical error. I have no idea, no intuition whether this should always be the case. But we don't see any difference. If it was different, then you the lowest one would be the true threshold. No. So you just have to search over some non-orthogonal spanning set of states. And then if you have a guarantee that you can preserve some non-orthogonal spanning set of states, right? So you take the lowest threshold for all of these states, so in this example, the zero and the plus state, and then below this lowest threshold, you know that, well, you infer that as L diverges, both of these states are preserved perfectly. And then you use this theorem to tell you that all states are preserved perfectly. Well, in the limit that L diverges. I mean, we don't have, this is all inference from numerical evidence.
Yeah, but there's presumably some, when it's not perfect preservation, and it's never perfect preservation.
Yeah. Of the space and so
on.
Yeah, so we don't have access to a theorem that allows us to make any quantitative statements about this. Basically, I mean, the papers that have this result that we talk about, I mean, a code space is perfectly preserved under a channel if the channel preserves generators in the matrix algebra of the code space, something like this. But this is like these information preserving structures paper, and it's all about zero error. So we don't really have access to quantitative statements about, you know, epsilon errors and so on. Yeah. So I don't have much.
Yeah, I guess it's probably okay because both of those things are constant. If it depends on the dimension of the holdover space, then you'd be in trouble.
Sure. Yeah. But this is really about preservation of a code space within as I said, we don't have good. We don't have much quantitative to say about epsilon and so on, but I expect from the structure of the proof of the theorem that it really only depends on the code space dimension, in which case we're fine. So that's the Ising fusion code. We can do the same thing for the toric code, and well, you see exactly the same thing. Again, there's some kind of threshold behavior around 0.25, 0.26. And so we conclude that it doesn't really matter which of these codes you choose. Similarly, we can look at the different decoders. So we choose the Ising fusion code under pair creation only white noise. This is the same plot that we had before. You can compare it to an RG decoder. And it looks much messier. It turns out that this is a generic feature, is that there seem to be a lot more finite size effects. And there's a little bit more computationally difficult to get up to large lattice sizes for these RG decoders, but presumably because PMA has such nice implementations. But if you are generous, you can imagine that there's a threshold somewhere in this region around 0.14. The lines go in the correct direction up here and in the reverse direction up here. You can also compare different sources of noise. So pair creation only is exactly the thing that we've been looking at. And we can look at the case where the hopping is the dominant source of noise. And again, we see, well, some kind of threshold behavior around 0.25. And this is a kind of generic feature that we see, is that it doesn't really matter how we choose these rates. The threshold doesn't seem to shift. I forgot to point out that even though the thresholds are the same, say, for this, the fusion code and the toric code, the actual failure rates very different. So at threshold, this is like 0.4 something, and up here, this is like 0.7 something. But I mean, this is kind of a higher order. Well, I mean, we're not particularly interested in this. This is a much more detailed question. The last thing that I want to say about Ising anions is we have this nice thermal noise plot. So we pick some temperature, and then you get some plot like this. And then you extract this memory lifetime, and then you plot it as a function of temperature. And you get a lovely exponential fit, which is basically what one expects by analogy with the toric code. I mean, really, the lesson is that everything works basically the same as the toric code, except with slightly different numbers, which is exactly what we expect. But it's nice to be able to see that and to see what things work better if you're trying to build a model, trying to build a computer and actually figure out what kind of decoding protocols you want to apply on it. You want to be able to simulate these and see and benchmark one kind of protocol against the other. So it's not. Oh, yeah. I mean, this is just something for an extremely simple commuting Hamiltonian. And, well, okay. So this thermal noise model is basically designed by analogy with the toric code. How would we put the toric code Hamiltonian into our framework and then do some kind of Metropolis simulation on it? And if you do the same thing for the Ising anions, this is what you get. But I agree. I mean, if you have a more complicated Hamiltonian that doesn't have a nice harmonic spectrum, then all kinds of interesting things are going to happen. But also, you typically lose most of your numerical tools to look at those situations. Okay, so intermediate summary of all of these results that we've got for the Ising anions is that this threshold value, I mean, it doesn't really depend on the details of what kind of code we choose or what kind of noise source we choose. The matching decoders seem to work better in terms of threshold than the RG decoders, and the memory lifetime is exponential in the inverse temperature. These are all the nice upshots from, say, somebody that's looking to implement such a thing. But the other factor that we can see is that we get much cleaner data from matching decoders. So if you're trying to benchmark, say, a code, probably better off using a matching decoder to benchmark it, because you can see much more cleanly the effect, unless you're specifically interested in an RG decoder. OK, excellent. So in the last part of my talk, I just want to briefly talk about. So the Ising anion model is very nice, and it's probably one of the, we expect it to be one of the first anion models to be realized. But without doing non-topological operations like magic state distillation, you can't build a universal quantum computer with rating of Ising anions. So we would like to be able to use similar tools to analyze actually universal quantum computer based on rating of anions. And so that's what we're going to look at in this section. And the simplest universal anion model is Fibonacci anions. So apart from vacuum, there's one non-trivial particle type called tau, and we have this fusion rule. We bring two taus together, and we ask what's the total charge. It could be vacuum or tau. Simple as you could imagine. And then if we imagine exchanging two taus, depending on what their total charge is, if it's vacuum, you get this factor. If it's tau, you get this factor. And well, you need some other data from the anion model to be able to completely specify everything that's happening. But it turns out that you can show that this gives a universal gate set. So I can do universal quantum computation by braiding of Fibonacci anions. Now, for our purposes, the unfortunate thing is that we don't expect to be able to classically simulate general braiding exactly for the reason that this gives us all of BQP. Well, if you could show how to do that, then you'd be very famous. So if we're going to have any hope of benchmarking error correction in these kinds of systems, we're either going to have to make horrendous approximations, which we don't want to do, or exploit the specific structure of noise processes. So we're not actually trying to simulate general dynamics of n Fibonacci anions. We're trying to simulate dynamics of some number of Fibonacci anions that specifically correspond to noise processes. And this gives us a lot of information that we can use to simplify the problem. So what does noise look like? So we're interested in this white noise setting. So noise acts basically on edges and sides. So if I have my lattice and I want to highlight all of the edges and sides that have some noise process acted on them, I choose some low rate of noise, and I get some plot like this. Now, the important thing to remember is that logical operators have to act globally. So they have to act on a macroscopic length scale. In this picture, we've chosen the noise rate low enough so that there's no noise process that acts on all of a set of edges that span the graph. But if we chose a higher noise rate, then we would find that that is the case. So in this here, we have, say, a noise process that could span the entire lattice. There's a nice connected path from one side of the lattice to the other. Now, because we're choosing edges and sites randomly, this is basically a percolation problem. So the important insight is that the structure of this white noise is exactly a percolation problem. And we expect percolated noise to lead to error correction failures. So if we've got a situation where noise has percolated across the lattice, we expect some logical operator has happened in an unrecoverable way. So we're not really interested in the regime where noise is percolated. We're really only interested in the sub-percolated regime, and this is key to the whole game. Right. So what's the key idea? If we've got our noise in this way, we break it up into different clusters, connected components of edges, and then anions in different connected components haven't interacted. At any point in their history, there's no like world lines that connect them. So their fusion spaces are going to be independent. Pretty straightforward. And then we look up a percolation theory textbook to see, well, what do we know about clusters? And it turns out, in the sub-percolated regime, clusters have average size log n, where n is the total number of sites in the lattice. This tells us that each cluster contains log many anions, again, in the system size. So each cluster only has a polynomially large fusion space associated with it, right? And so we can classically simulate the dynamics within our cluster. And we know that we don't need to worry about interactions between clusters for the reason that they're all independent. So we can perfectly well simulate sub-percolated noise dynamics. But there's a second half to the problem, which is that we don't want to just simulate noise. We also want to simulate recovery. So we need a decoding protocol that respects this kind of clustering structure. So the most natural thing to use is one of these RG decoders. And the proof of this is not actually in the literature yet, but we're working on a nice way to phrase it. The proof that we can simulate all of this efficiently. But it basically boils down to the fact that, the same reason that the RG decoder has a threshold, which is that noise processes, if the noise is sufficiently low strength, then noise acts only on far separate, well, it has small clusters of noise that are far separated. And that's what makes the RG decoder work. And that's also what gives us this the simulability of the noise. So these two things play together very nicely. And that's important. So if we were to choose a matching decoder, we would have no way of guaranteeing this, for example. Now, you could just try and simulate what happens with a matching decoder. But we haven't, because it doesn't work very well. So the motto is, when the clusters begin to merge, so when our error correction, our decoding algorithm starts to bring different clusters together, that's when we expect error correction to fail. That's when we expect error correction to fail, but that's also when our simulation fails. So simulation failure and error correction failure are basically order of magnitude the same thing in this problem. So the practical implication is that we should be able to simulate successful error correction but we're not really going to have much luck simulating failed error correction. So we can guarantee, so we can simulate and show that you can succeed in doing error correction, but we can only give you a lower bound on the threshold, say, something like this. So the main technical difference between the simulation of these universal anions and the Ising anions is that you need to choose a more sensible basis for your fusion space. So in the Ising anion case, we had to choose some linear ordering of these sites. We just chose this nice big snake. Everything was very pretty. But this is a horrible idea if you're trying to do the universal case, because it doesn't respect the structure of these clusters. So basically, you need to build a dynamic basis for the fusion space as the clusters grow. So for each cluster, we build some linear ordering within that cluster. And then we have all of these different fusion spaces for each cluster. And then this allows us to in this basis, the fusion space factorizes over the clusters. So that's the main technical difference in these simulations, that you have to use a dynamic fusion basis. But you can do that if you're clever enough, and our numerics people were. So here's the results that we get. So we're going to look at the behavior of the Fibonacci toric code. So we have Fibonacci anions on the torus, say. We're going to look at pair creation only white noise because that seems like a sensible thing to do. And we'll use the RG decoder because we need to have something that respects this nice clustering structure. And this is the plot we get. So, well, yeah, also in between doing the numerics on the Ising anions and the numerics on the Fibonacci anions, our code got a lot better. So we're able to push to higher ladder sizes. But you can see some pretty convincing behavior of that there exists some kind of threshold down here at 0.125-ish. So below this, we expect good error correction. Above this, we expect to fail. So that's basically the result, is that we're able to benchmark this error correction protocol. I mean, it's not surprising that it works. It might be surprising that you can actually show that it works numerically on a classical computer. So that's basically the end of my talk. So what have we learned? Well, we've got some general framework for modeling noise and error correction in anion systems. And, well, from doing some simulations of this, we learned that the thresholds aren't particularly sensitive to most of the details of how we set this up. So that might be nice for an experimentalist. He doesn't actually have to be careful. He can choose things as convenient. And we had a look at how to classically simulate successful error correction, even for universal anion models, where you might think that this is an extremely difficult problem. That's the caveat, is we're able to successfully simulate successful error correction, but we can't actually simulate the failures. The simulation fails at the same time as the error correction. Take-home message is we can benchmark error correction protocols for topological quantum computers. This is what we wanted to be able to do, and now we've got all of the tools that we are actually able to do this. So there's a few interesting open questions. Is how do you deal with more? So we've got this naive phenomenological model of noise where anions are precisely localized and noise acts on these edges in this very nice way. You might wonder, well, if I know a bit more about the microscopic details of where my anions are coming from and how noise might act on the actual degrees of freedom of my system, can I use the same ideas to simulate error correction in some more concrete scenario? And in particular, you might wonder what happens if I'm away from the RG fixed point. So if my particles aren't precisely localized, there's an extremely interesting question. Obviously, fault tolerance is a big thing. So in all of the simulations that we've done here, we've assumed perfect measurements and the ability to perfectly do recovery operations and stuff. But that's not a particularly realistic thing. The obvious next step is to try and build fault tolerant decoders. And there's a lot of work towards this, but it's still early days for non-abelian anion systems. And then, well, now that we've got tools to numerically simulate and show how well error correction protocols work for these, you might actually want to figure out what's the most practical one for a given scenario. That's really what this allows you to do. So that's all I've got. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Models or
oh, the white ones.
Natural.
Oh, see, so yeah, these noise operations, yeah.
Yeah. So has anyone looked at how exactly they would arise in a particular implementation, say, for example, optical lattices, how the noise at the physical level would be interpreted in terms of the noise?
I have no idea about something so concrete as an optical lattice. I mean, this is a...
Well, any particular...
Well, I mean, so there's some work on looking at if I have some concrete spin model,
yeah.
So like a string net model or something. Well, I could imagine that the natural thing for white noise to do is act like a depolarizing channel on each of my qubits or something.
I guess I'm saying a little bit more. So, you know, something in a lab.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Rather than an abstract model where you just put whatever noise model you want on, how do real systems, not any particular thing, how does the noise from that translate into the noise?
I have no idea. I mean, I'm sure there are people that know about the sources of noise in their lab. But I don't. And once you're getting down to these kinds of details, and you have to be much more specific in pointing to a specific implementation, like architecture, that this applies to words, we've tried to set it up as generally as possible. I'll comment also that, so these operations that I've described, these are all, well, this is basically all of the topological operations that can happen. I mean, the only things that can happen topologically is you can create and move in the anions. But there's also random microscopic crap in whatever system you have. So there's likely to be a lot of non-topological noise sources. We just don't expect them to really, I mean, play into the decoding of the model when you're specifically encoding in topological degrees of freedom. So, I mean, short answer is I have no idea, and it's an important problem, but we hope that we've captured everything that is actually important in this abstraction.
You didn't have errors that changed the charge.
Well, so, I mean, we have some notion of a local charge conservation. It's what a particle type is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a conserved charge. And then within this constraint...
But that's what the non-topological errors would do, probably.
Well, there could also be... Well, yeah, I don't know. So I mean, if you allow such an operation, then I don't think you would really call your model topological anymore.
Charge is really not like some thing that you can punch out and get rid of. It's like if you have some localized object that you have disposed of, which is like far away, and it's so the charge information of the charge is very well protected.
Yeah, but then this more naturally falls into the fault tolerance question rather than the we hope that the model's been set up, like the microscopic dynamics is set up in such a way that exactly this thing is forbidden. Otherwise, we don't really want to regard it as being a topological model. And we know that this is what happens in these concrete implementations that I talked about. I mean, there is no way in a Torah code to locally remove a charge. When I say like there's also microscopic non-topological stuff happening, you might have some additional local degrees of freedom in your system, and they might give you some observable consequence of some error, but that shouldn't affect somehow the topological dynamics that's described by the anion model. This is the idea.
Sure. I mean that would be largely irrelevant, except as another source of decoding error.
Yeah.
But.
I don't know if anyone's looked at the kind of errors you might get if you did like a trotterization simulation, and like I'm imagining an optical lattice or something like that, and where you implement this by performing nearest neighbor operations.
Where we implement what? Like the.
Where you implement the dynamics.
Oh.
Time slice, in time steps.
I mean, some people are looking at these kinds of things. I mean, you can prepare topologically ordered states by having some kind of non-time invariant Hamiltonian, for example, by doing some pulsing. But I don't know. I mean, a model for noise, I mean, our noise is the sources of noise that we're trying to consider are really
some kind of continuous time Monte Carlo approximation thing, and you're already discrete in that setting. So the other thing that it's important to be able to discretize as you're going heading towards fault tolerance is the recovery map. So we've just allowed ourselves arbitrary recovery operations, like we can take two particles here and bring them to here in one time step, but as an intermediate step towards fault tolerance, you might imagine it takes you some time to bring a particle from here to there, and you need to worry about errors all the way along this time, and this is the kind of thing that's been started to be considered. But I don't know if that answers any of your questions.
Did you think about doing this kind of analysis to like the Majorana wire junctions? Because that seems like an easier thing to analyze if it's near the brightness and compared to.
We didn't think about this, but that's probably an interesting thing to do. I mean, so some people have started looking at braiding errors. There was a paper a few months ago about if you have Majorana wire junctions, then you try and do braiding, then you lose all your topological protection. This is presumably relevant. But I don't think anybody's directly looked at some kind of error correction protocol, I mean, numerically, in this situation. That's an excellent point.
There is a paper by Peterson, too.
Remember the detail, but one of the conclusions is that they have to monitor the system very quickly before the Majorana particles approach the junction.
Other questions? Cool.
So let's thank Courtney.